Hopkins. Bryant for the win.
Interviews from your favorite local coaches and athletes.
He's getting to the basket at will, and he's hitting that three-point shot with some consistency now, and he's just in a groove right now where he's pretty well unstoppable.
Hall of Fame and legendary guests.
I was driven by loving to play, liking the challenge of being an NFL quarterback, but after 18 years, I was 1 month short of 39 years old. It's time to go.
Analysis and insight on the latest national sports topics. Live from the Auto Farm Studios, it's Drive Time Sports with Jordan Buscarini on KOAL 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM.
Welcome back into a brand new edition of Drive Time Sports. We're live from the Auto Farm Studios. I'm your host, Jordan Buscarini. Ready to go on this very busy Thursday show. We have a couple of fun conversations on tap for today. We're going to bring back in one of my favorite authors. That's Galen White. Galen is one of the best baseball historians you will ever meet. I've been very blessed over the course of 10 years here on Drive Time Sports to garner some relationships, make some relationships with some people that I highly admired before I got into this field. Galen White was one of them. I mean, as far as this guy's writing ability, it's phenomenal. And one of the things that I appreciate most about Galen, his studies and his writings typically revolve around minor league baseball. Some of the great players that we never talk about. And today we're going to talk about one of his books that came out about 6 years ago. It's called The Bilko Athletic Club. Now, if you're familiar with Los Angeles baseball at all, you know who Steve Bilko is. If you aren't too familiar with Steve Bilko, we're going to have a great conversation about him today. In fact, the Los Angeles Dodgers owe Steve Bilko an awful lot. When the Dodgers relocated from Brooklyn to L.A., they struggled that first year heavily. The Dodgers make a trade. They bring in Steve Bilko. In 1956, Bilko was a Triple Crown winner in the Pacific Coast League. That was the same year that Mickey Mantle was going after Babe Ruth. So it's a tremendous story, and I'm really looking forward to Galen White joining us. That'll be next segment here on Drive Time Sports. And then we're going to be joined by my friend Steve Bordstein. Steve, longtime radio analyst in the world of sports. We're going to talk basically marketing in sports, but we're going to do it in a more fun way than just talking about marketing. For instance, yesterday, USC officially ended their disassociation with former Heisman Trophy winner Reggie Bush. Now, that wasn't USC's doing. I can't stress that enough. The NCAA has a rule in place, and this came about in 2017, that there's a 10-year gap that schools must disassociate themselves with a player who has been found violating certain rules. So, for instance, Reggie Bush, he had his Heisman revoked. USC, it was mandated by the NCAA that they spent 10 years apart of disassociation. That came to a close yesterday. USC welcomed back Reggie Bush. And as far as I'm concerned, it's hogwash anyway, right? Because you can't erase the memories. You can take the national championship banner away from USC, rightfully so. You can take Reggie Bush's Heisman Trophy away from him, rightfully so. But you're never going to erase what we saw during Bush's tenure at USC, which was the closest thing to professional football from an excitement standpoint that Los Angeles had in well over a decade. You can't erase that. And I hope that history looks back on what that USC football team was and remembers it fondly, because it was unbelievable. Matt Leinart, Reggie Bush, Lendell White, Dwayne Jarrett, that team was fantastic. The ringleader of all that was Pete Carroll. And so for those who believe that USC should continue to distance themselves from Reggie Bush, I point to Pete Carroll. And I would say, why was Pete Carroll able to walk away from USC? No sanctions, no punishment whatsoever, get a pay raise, and go to the NFL to coach the Seattle Seahawks, while USC and Reggie Bush had their names dragged through the mud. And if you look at that USC football program, it hasn't recovered since. Now, this is just one instance, But since it's fresh in the minds of everyone following the events yesterday of Reggie Bush and USC shaking hands and seeing Reggie Bush back on campus, yada, 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 all that great stuff, it's a relevant conversation, right? The coaches in that regard get absolutely no blame. They get absolutely no punishment. They leave, they take another job. The sanctions don't follow them. So the school, they're going to embrace it now, and I assure you, when you walk on USC's campus, you're going to see Reggie Bush jerseys hanging up at the bookstore for sale, and they will pull a profit off of it. Absolutely. 100%. Guaranteed. I believe you can correlate this as to what's happening right now with the NFL. There's been a lot of controversy as far as social rights and which voices can be heard and how can you go about voicing your own personal beliefs. The NFL's been the center point of that in professional sports for the better part of 5 years now. And the NFL has come out this week and apologized for what happened in 2016, basically saying they were wrong. Why is the NFL doing that? It's a marketing ploy. See, all this kind of ties together. It's a conversation that we don't typically have here on Drive Time Sports, but I am looking forward to it. We'll get into that in just a bit here on the show. Now, let's take a look at what's happening in the national sports front, and we will begin with Major League Baseball. Alex Cora, disgraced former Red Sox manager and Astros bench coach, shouldered some of the blame for his responsibility in the sign-stealing saga that people have just magically forgot about because of everything that's gone on with Major League Baseball and us not knowing if we're going to get a 2020 season at all. But he wasn't ready to shoulder all of the blame. It's the first time we have heard from Alex Cora, and he only has a season-long suspension, which I thought Rob Manfred was very, very lenient with. I thought Cora probably deserved a lifetime ban because it wasn't just one season, it wasn't just one franchise, it was multiple franchises that were investigated for wrongdoings that Cora had a direct impact on. Cora said today that it was more than a two-man job, and what he means by that, it was more than just him and Carlos Beltran. Here's the quote: "If there's one thing that I completely reject and disagree with, it's people within the Astros organization singling me out, particularly former general manager Jeff Luhnow, as if I were the sole mastermind. The commissioner's report sort of explained in its own way what happened, but the Astro players have spoken up and refuted any allegations that I was solely responsible." End quote. This is such an interesting cheating scandal in baseball. It really is. And Cora, for the most part, has kept a low profile since the allegations and the final reports came out with the Astros, and really the Red Sox got a slap on the wrist. Really what it boils down to, Alex Cora, I don't know that he was the mastermind, but he was the focal point of it. And the reason why I say he was the focal point of it is because it happened when he was in Houston, and then it happened when he was in Boston, right, consecutive years. And to go away from the whole "he said, she said, it's his fault" deal, here's what I find so fascinating about it, and there hasn't been a lot of work done on this. The Astros and the Red Sox went toe-to-toe in the ALCS. And you know, when A.J. Hinch and the Astros lost to the Red Sox, the Astros knew what had happened. They knew that there was sign-stealing going on. Right? I think it's over and done with. Cora, he spoke to ESPN after a charity event, and I don't know how much more we're going to get from Cora. I'm also curious to see if he ever has another role within Major League Baseball again. I don't believe he will, at least not anytime soon, but nonetheless, it still makes for an extremely fun conversation, right? It's so interesting the way Major League Baseball decided to handle this particular issue compared to some of the others that we have seen over the last few years. Red Sox kind of got swept under the rug. The Astros, for the most part, again, it was a slap on the hand as well. They got like a $5 million fine. They didn't get a first or a second round draft pick. And that's it. It kind of works along the same lines as USC. Rob Manfred didn't take away the championship. In fact, Rob Manfred did a terrific job of devaluing a World Series championship by calling it a piece of metal, which really irritated a lot of people in the Major League Baseball ranks. Even if he would have taken it away, you're not going to, you can't erase the memory of an epic 2017 World Series in which the Houston Astros came out on top. Really, those are the main stories coming out of the national sports front today. Not a lot is happening, but we're still going to have fun over the next hour here on Drive Time Sports. Also, in just a moment, we're going to give you the local sports recap. The Helper American Legion baseball team, they'll continue play tonight. They'll take on Tooele at 8 p.m. That's after they beat Union last night 6-2. You can get your complete recap of that game right now at CastleCountryRadio.com. So a local sports recap coming up. We're going to talk to Galen White, one of my favorite authors, about Steve Bilko, a very interesting figure in minor league and even professional baseball. And we're going to talk NFL and college football. That's all coming up on this edition of Drive Time Sports, live from the Auto Farm Studios.
Pitch to Bellinger. He swings and he hits a high fly ball right center field. This ball's gone!
Now a 3-1 for Acuna. Swinging a high fly ball! Deep to left field! Way, way back! It's gone!
Live from the Auto Farm Studios, it's Drive Time Sports on KOAL 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM.
Back on Drive Time Sports, live from the Auto Farm Studios, 107.3 FM and 7:50 AM. A lot of baseball talk going on right now. Of course, we have the draft going on last night, round one and round A. Always interesting. And of course, we have the idea of will there or won't there be baseball? We're going to take a step away from that kind of talk, and we're going to bring in one of my favorite baseball authors and historians, Galen White. And Galen has joined us several times on the show, joining us once again today. Galen, thank you for the time. I really appreciate it.
Good to talk with you, Jordan.
Galen, you and I have talked about multiple avenues of your work. The last time we had you on, we talked about Stuck on Base in the Bush Leagues, which is a fantastic book. Today, we're going to rewind the hands of time. We're going to go back a few years to a book that you wrote called The Bilko Athletic Club. And one of the things that I found so fascinating about this book, it really puts it in perspective just how great 1956 really was for the game of baseball. Now, of course, this work right here focuses on Steve Bilko and what he managed to accomplish in the Pacific Coast League. All in all, a terrific work. So I have to ask you, why the Bilko Athletic Club? When you decide, okay, this is the project that I'm going to undertake and it's going to take you a long time to complete, what was it about this story that made you say, yes, there's something here?
Truth is, when I started interviewing Steve Bilko and some of the other ball players, I had one book in mind, and that was Left on Base in the Bush Leagues, which, of course, is my latest book. But as my research accumulated, I realized I had more than one book. And so I took the Bilko material and broke it out into the Bilko Athletic Club. And the reason for that was that the 1956 Los Angeles Angels team, which earned the nickname the Bilko Athletic Club, deserved a book to itself because many consider it to be the last great minor league team. A few years later, you had expansion come in, and the minor leagues, while there were still some very good teams in the minors, and the Salt Lake City Bees had some good ones as well, they weren't as good as they were before expansion.
Well, let's talk about Steve Bilko. And again, you mentioned the year 1956. I guess most baseball fans will remember 56 because of Mickey Mantle, right? But if you go to the Pacific Coast League, something spectacular was happening with Steve Bilko as well. In that same year, he wins the PCL's Triple Crown, batting 360, hitting 55 home runs and 164 RBIs, a spectacular year. So you kind of have joint historical seasons going on between two different leagues.
Well, keep in mind, there was no Major League Baseball west of Kansas City. So growing up in Los Angeles, as I did, the closest we had to the majors was the Coast League. Bilko had already played in the majors. In fact, in 1953, he had hit 21 home runs for the St. Louis Cardinals. That was his rookie year. And then he came out to L.A. in 55. By 56, he was the biggest thing in L.A. In fact, his manager, Bob Sheffing, said more people in L.A. Know about Bilko than Marilyn Monroe. Now, that's a pretty tall claim. But that was the way it was in 1956. He was a celebrity. In fact, the television show, there was a television show at that time called You'll Never Get Rich, and it starred Silvers, and the character he played was Sergeant Bilko. Now, some of your younger listeners will remember Steve Martin playing Sergeant Bilko in a movie. The name Bilko
in the television series as well as the movie was inspired by Steve Bilkel. Phil Silvers once was asked about this, and he said, "Well, I could have just as well have been Corporal Hodges after Gil Hodges, or Private First Class Musial after Stan Musial. I gave it to a guy who needed it."
So going back and looking over the career of Steve Bilko, again, you mentioned he had played professional baseball, but I think it is most intriguing to me, Galen, that his most successful years as a player came from 55 through 57 when he was in the minors.
Yes, in Los Angeles, he played 3 years for the Coastal League Angels. Now, he returned in 1958 to play for the Los Angeles Dodgers, and that's important because the Dodgers were facing a public referendum to get approval to build Dodger Stadium where it's currently located today. There was a great deal of controversy and opposition to their building it in the Chavez Ravine area because it was a historic Hispanic area. So there was a lot of opposition, and the Dodgers needed someone to sort of put them over the top at the polls. So they traded Don Newcomb for Steve Bilko in June of that year, just about a month before the election. And Bilko helped them win that referendum. And Buzzy Bavasi, the general manager of the Dodgers, later said that they ought to name a street around Dodger Stadium after Bilko, because in large part he was responsible for their winning that referendum and getting the ballpark and getting permission to build the ballpark there in Chavez Ravine. 1956, the great year for Bilko when he won the Triple Crown, again to show you how popular he was. There was a columnist in LA who wrote this: "A vote against Mantle and Bilko is a vote against home, mother, and bottled beer. Mickey is a cinch to get the ballot of every man and woman who can tell the difference between a three-base hit and a crock of cumwats. Bilko, of course, is a cinch to sweep California, and since the vice presidential candidacy seems to be a matter of grave concern and a campaign issue of stirring dimensions, it is comforting to know we have a nominee who is popular with one and all, except possibly the pitchers. Stout Steve is threatened with decapitation while taking a turn at bat." That was from a columnist in L.A., and it speaks to Bilko's popularity on the West Coast. And, of course, Mantle, of course, was popular around the country. That 56, of course, was a presidential year. It was Eisenhower running against Adlai Stevenson. So this particular columnist was recommending Mickey Mantle at the top of the ticket and Steve Bilko as vice president.
Again, Galen White, our guest right now, as we talk about one of his books, The Bilko Athletic Club, The Story of the 1956 Los Angeles Angels. Galen, when you sent me the book, you put an underscore of chapter 16, which I found very fascinating, and I want to go back to it. I know you briefly glanced over it just a moment ago, but Bilko getting traded to the Dodgers for Don Newcomb, really, and how important that was for the Dodgers' the Dodgers' run in Los Angeles, because Walter O'Malley and the Dodgers, I mean, that was not a great season for L.A., and Bilko, as you mentioned, did provide a little bit of excitement. I'm always curious as to the stories behind certain players and what they mean to the franchise. For instance, here in the state of Utah, I believe Adrian Dantley played dividends for the Utah Jazz. They may not be in Utah if it wasn't for Adrian Dantley. So when you put that into terms of what Bilko meant to the Dodgers in 1958, you can't overstate it.
Bilko was the most popular athlete in L.A. prior to Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale in the 60s. You have to go that far into Major League Baseball coming to L.A. The Dodgers came to L.A. in 1958, but nobody really resonated with the fans there until Koufax, of course, in the 60s, and Drysdale. Bilko, up to that point, was the man. He came back to L.A. again in 1961 with the expansion Los Angeles Angels. That was when the American League went from 8 to 10 teams. The first year they played in Wrigley Field. Now, Wrigley Field, yes, Los Angeles had a Wrigley Field, and it was patterned after the one in Chicago. And Bilko was known as a home pro because he hit so many home runs there. He returned in 1961 and hit 20 home runs there at Wrigley Field or for the Angels in 61. And then 62, he went with the Angels and played at what they referred to as Chavez Ravine, but it was the same place, Dodger Stadium. The ballpark was completed by that time. So Bilko actually did play in Dodger Stadium, the ballpark that he helped permission to build. But Bilko was a institution in Los Angeles. People there still remember him. He was inducted into the Baseball Reliquary Shrine of the Eternals in 2015, and there was a folk singer who did a special song on Steve Bilko, and it was the words were at the end. It says, "Angelino Bambino, working class coal miner's son. He was our Babe Ruth, Mickey Mantle, and Ted Williams rolled into one."
It's really phenomenal when you just think about the impact that he actually had. Galen, when you write a book about someone like Steve Bilko, who passed away very young, right, at the age of 49 years old, how difficult is that, knowing that, boy, by the time you get this book published, he's been gone for over 30 years?
When the book came out in 2014, I gave a presentation in the Los Angeles area, and the person who introduced me, a very highly respected baseball person, said, "This is a great book, but it should have been done 20 years earlier." I agreed entirely. I wish it had been done earlier so that more people who saw him play could read the book. But I also said that it would have been a different book. I think I have a greater perspective now, or when I wrote the book. I had the benefit of more research material. Before the internet, everything was through microfilm. Of course, I had interviewed Steve at his home in Nanticoke, Pennsylvania. I spent an entire day with him, so I had the benefit of that. I'd interviewed many of his teammates and guys who played against him. So I had a lot of information already, but I think coming out a little bit later made it a slightly different book. And also, I was able to present it within the context of this great 1956 Angels team, which one of his teammates was one of the all-time great managers, Gene Mauch, who managed in the big leagues with the Angels and with the Montreal Expos, the Philadelphia Phillies, an outstanding manager, although he never won a World Series.
Galen, we talk about baseball. It's America's pastime. You know, my thought process, especially here on the show, is there's nothing like high school athletics. I love high school athletics. For whatever reason, I've always been drawn to leagues such as the WNBA. I love minor league baseball as well. I love some of the lesser leagues that don't necessarily get the attention. And anytime I read one of your books, I'm learning something new. It's a history lesson on players that have made an impact that haven't necessarily received their attention. And you got four books that we have talked about: Left on Base in the Bush Leagues, Singles and Smiles. We've talked about Handsome Ransom Jackson, The Accidental Big Leaguer, and now the Bilko Athletic Club. These are books that provide historical context. I mean, really, these are things that played a major impact on the game of baseball. They just don't get the credit when you talk about America's pastime. And that's what I love about your work.
Well, thank you very much. I've always been fascinated with the line, and it's a very fine line, between an outstanding minor league player and a guy who succeeds in the majors. It depends on a lot of different things, not just on their own ability. Steve Bilko was a big man. He was about 6'1". His weight varied anyway between 230 and 270. In today's game, we don't think a whole lot about a big guy, a heavy guy. We've seen guys like Cecil Fielder, Prince Fielder, other guys. But at that time, most of the baseball players were like Ted Williams or Ernie Banks, Henry Aaron. They were slender. Bilko was a big man, so he was constantly under pressure to lose weight. That was one of the issues with him with the Cardinals. They one spring training had him wear a rubber suit so he would lose 30 pounds. And it was, Joe Grosjean said, it was almost inhumane what they did to him. Bilko was a power hitter. I was 10 years old in 1956, and to me, he looked like Babe Ruth because he was big. He could hit a ball as far as I heard that Babe Ruth hit him, and I didn't know at the time. I knew, of course, that Babe Ruth was a renowned beer drinker, but so was Bilko. In fact, he had an unusual way of losing weight, and that was he would go into the bathroom, turn up the shower as high as it would go, get it hot like a steam room, and then he'd sit on the side of the tub drinking a six-pack. Now, that was his way of losing weight. But he was a great, a lovable guy. Everybody liked him. And I once asked Jim Brosnan, who was a relief pitcher in the majors, a teammate of Bilko's, also a roommate, and I asked him the very question that you posed, and that is this difference between a minor leaguer and a major leaguer. And he said that Bilko to him was like Ferdinand the Bull. He was not quite sure of himself until he could prove himself to himself. And by not getting the same sort of applause and recognition in the majors that he had in the minors, he couldn't accept himself as a major leaguer. I thought that was an interesting insight. Jim Brosnan, by the way, was known as the professor because he wrote a couple of books on baseball. But Steve Bilko, I think the only thing he lacked was confidence. He had confidence in his own abilities, but he didn't have confidence that the managers he was playing for would stick him in the lineup and let him play day in and day out to prove he belonged in the majors.
Again, Galen White, our guest right now. Galen, it truly is a fascinating story. Again, I did mention some of your other works as well. I think this is a perfect time to give you an opportunity to let the listeners know where they can find more of your work.
Amazon.com is the best place. The publisher is Roman, R-O-W-M-A-N, and Littlefield. You can go on their website, and they may well be offering a special on one or more of the books. After all, we don't have any baseball to watch, so you might as well read about it. And when I write about these books about these players, it's not just about the game. I'm very pleased that several readers have gotten back to me and said that they were not necessarily baseball fans, but they enjoyed the human interest stories, which all the books have quite a bit of human interest in them. The story about Steve Bilko is a great one, and to some degree it's a tragic one because he died young. But I think it speaks also, though, that he was such a great player and a hero to so many people. The columnist Jim Murray, the Los Angeles Times, famous columnist, once described Steve Bilko as an authentic American folk hero, and he really was to a lot of us growing up in the 50s and 60s.
Galen White, again, our guest. Galen, I always look forward to the conversations. Thank you so much for always taking out the time to join us and to share the history and the inside stories of your work and to talk about these figures. It really is always a pleasure, so thank you very much.
Jordan, thank you.
We've got to take a quick commercial break, but we do have more Drive Time Sports coming up when we return. Again, we are live from the Auto Farm Studios on 107.3 FM and 750 AM.
Live from the KOAL newsroom at Price, Utah, it's Drive Time Sports on 107.3 FM and 750 AM.
Take that for data.
We're back on Drive Time Sports, live from the Auto Farm Studios on 107.3 FM and 750 AM. I'm looking forward to this next conversation. It's going to be good. We're going to talk college and NFL football. And we're joined right now by a great friend of mine and a great friend of the show, Steve Bordstein. Steve, it's a pleasure to get you back on. I've enjoyed our conversations. They've kind of strayed from the normal over the last few weeks, but it's definitely been fun. Different types of conversations.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on with you again, and certainly there's been no normal for a while now, so I'm glad to have added to those conversations a little bit.
Well, let's start by talking about college football, and I want to get your opinion, not necessarily on the situation. We can talk about the situation, but it's an NCAA rule. And yesterday, former USC running back Reggie Bush, the disassociation from the university has come to a close. And one of the things that I don't think people really understand is it wasn't USC telling Reggie Bush, we don't want anything to do with you, and then saying, okay, it's been long enough, welcome back. No, no, no. That's not the way it works. There is a timing issue that comes in with the results of an NCAA committee infraction rule. It was adopted in 2017. It limits any mandated disassociation between an individual and a school for 10 years. Reggie Bush's disassociation began in June of 2010. Therefore, it has come to a close. You're a hardcore USC guy. You're a USC alum. Everybody that listens to the show knows this. We had this conversation during the NFL draft. I'm curious as to your thoughts now that Reggie Bush is once again a part of the USC allure, this tradition, this rich history that they have in college football.
There's going to be a theme to this entire conversation, and it's a marketing theme, right? We'll get to the NFL part of that here in a moment. This is a marketing thing for USC, and it's a positive for USC, and it's a positive for college football. Don't forget, Reggie Bush's sort of involvement again in college football really started a year or two ago when he became a regular on Fox's college football pregame show and postgame show. He has slowly but surely now started to integrate himself, ingratiate himself at the same time in the world of college football. He now appears on Fox. He was on there with Urban Meyer for a while. He was on there with Matt Leinart for a little while. He's a part of their broadcast. So him having some insight now in college football, and now having him back with the school that made him a legend, we'll get to that here in a second, is a good thing for everyone involved. It's a good thing for USC, it's a good thing for college football, and it's a good thing for Fox, who broadcasts college football. So from a marketing standpoint, it makes sense. Now, the USC part of this is sticky, because USC kind of went out of their way to disassociate themselves from Reggie Bush after the scandal that broke out regarding his improper benefits. Remember, his roster, his jersey, still doesn't appear in the Coliseum. They have the jerseys, the Hall of Fame area, the Coliseum, where they had all the jerseys on display. O.J. Simpson's is up there, but not Reggie Bush's, which is still kind of odd to a lot of people. I can certainly understand why. So it was this whole idea of Reggie Bush was persona non grata for a little while. I'm okay with Reggie Bush being a part of USC, but under no circumstances, and you and I had this conversation off here, under no circumstances do I want Pete Carroll ever a part of USC. I'm not so mad at Reggie Bush. He was given benefits. Of course he's going to take those benefits. Any 19, 20-year-old kid would have been out of their mind to not take those benefits. It was Pete Carroll, and it was Mike Garrett, and it was the administration, it was the sports administration of that university that allowed this to happen and allowed USC to be put in that position. Therefore, I'm okay with Reggie Bush sort of being welcomed back into the fold. Under no circumstances, though, should Pete Carroll be allowed back in that fold.
Yeah, and I've had this same train of thought for a very long time. I've been very hard on Pete Carroll. I don't have a lot of kind things to say about Pete Carroll. And look, I'll use this analogy. If my 5-year-old daughter sticks a fork in an outlet socket and she gets shocked, she's not to blame. I'm to blame, okay? Because I'm her parent and I'm supposed to be watching over her. To me, that's an equal analogy when we take a look at what happened at USC. Pete Carroll was 110% at fault for what happened. And to make matters worse, he not only bolted from USC, a place where he had built a college football empire. And for those who are unaware, USC football wasn't quite on the same level as Dodger baseball or Laker basketball in LA, but it was pretty close, Steve. I mean, it was a close third right behind those two. That's how big USC football was in SoCal at that particular time. Pete Carroll knew what was coming down. He bolted, then played dumb at the press conference, acting like he had absolutely no idea any of this was coming down the chute. Pete Carroll was 110% responsible for what happened at USC. Now, when I say that, I probably have a little bit of a soft spot in my heart for Reggie Bush and Lendell White. I can't believe I'm saying this because I'm not a USC guy at all, but it was absolutely brilliant the way they performed on the football field. Matt Leinart, is one of the greatest college football quarterbacks I have personally ever watched. It's sad that that particular era has been swiped from the record books, but the fact remains, it's not necessarily the kids' fault. It's Pete Carroll, who was making millions and millions of dollars to run a clean program and have institutional control.
You made the comparison of the Dodgers and the Lakers. I'll keep it in college football. Before Alabama and Clemson became Alabama and Clemson that we know of today, that was USC.
No question.
That was USC 15 years ago, 13 years ago. They were that big. It was that level. You did not talk about college football without talking about, well, who's going to play USC for the national championship, whether it was LSU, whether it was Oklahoma, or whether it was Texas. Those were the games every single year for those 3 years, 2004, 2005, 2006, in college football. So, who was there? Pete Carroll. So he's there. To your point earlier about how he's 110% complicit in this, 110% responsible in this, if you believe that he's not, then you have to convince me that either A, Pete Carroll hired people who went behind his back, which makes him responsible, or B, that Pete Carroll was completely unaware of the fact that his staff was giving out these benefits, which again falls on the shoulders of Pete Carroll. So he's either lying or he's the most idiotic human being on the planet. Either way, he's responsible, and he's the reason why USC was in that position for so long. And let's also remember, what did Pete Carroll leave behind in his wake? A few years of Lane Kiffin, Steve Sarkisian. I mean, this was a disaster for USC, a disaster that we haven't seen in college football since the days of SMU.
Again, Steve Bortstein, our guest right now. Again, we're talking about marketing over the course of college football and, of course, NFL as well. And, Steve, you mentioned that marketing was going to be a reoccurring theme during this particular conversation, and we can actually draw this now into the NFL. And it's a topic that we don't discuss an awful lot here on Drive Time Sports, but with everything that's going on right now, it is kind of just it is the weirdest year to be associated with sports in any sort of capacity. And the NFL has kind of been the focal point of a lot of social issues, a lot of social, I don't even know how to word this, a lot of social talk, right? I don't even know how to word it.
A lot of things happening around the country, and the NFL wants their piece of it.
Yes, they're right in the middle of it once again. And I have to explain this. I've explained this to several people. This has absolutely nothing to do with the NFL caring one iota about the social issues. This has everything to do with the NFL and marketing. This is a billion-dollar organization, right? This is what this is all built around. It's marketing. Do you disagree?
No, completely agree. And this goes back to a conversation that we had several years ago, okay? When Ray Rice was videoed beating his girlfriend, his fiance at the time. The NFL was livid, right? Everyone was livid for good reason. Don't beat your girlfriend. Don't beat your wife. Don't beat your fiance. That's explainable. What was the NFL's response to it? Well, they went after Ray Rice. They went after the Baltimore Ravens. And then they launched a marketing campaign about the domestic violence issue and what a horrifying thing it is. And they launched a marketing campaign. You couldn't watch an NFL football game without there being commercials all over it. Before that, it was breast cancer, which, again, very personal topic, a very difficult topic, but you don't see them doing commercials about other types of cancer. Why? Well, because breast cancer sells jerseys. We can make pink jerseys, and the NFL can put pink ribbons on things, and they can put them online, and they can put them on the NFL shop, and they can promote those things. It's all a marketing thing. Okay, so then the Colin Kaepernick thing comes up. They want nothing to do with that. Remember, 2016, remember the world we lived in 2016, which now seems like decades ago. But again, Donald Trump was the president. He had just been elected. We were very rah-rah, pro-American. I'm not saying that we're not now, but the NFL didn't want anything to do with that. So they steered themselves as far away from Colin Kaepernick and the flag protests as possible. Well, now here we are. We're in 2020. The world's a vastly different place now than it was in 2016, and the NFL now finds themselves in that enviable position as far as marketing is concerned, where now they can say, you know what? Colin Kaepernick was right. He was right all along, and we do need to be more socially aware of what's happening in our inner communities, particularly in the areas of Detroit, where the Lions play, particularly in areas of Minneapolis, where the Vikings play, particularly in areas of Houston, where the Texans play. So we want to be very active in this area. We want to show our support for these inner cities because there's teams that play there, and we want to make sure that we can sell a few more jerseys in these cities, and we can also get fans who may not be able to go to games, but they can still be active in watching games. So we want to do the right thing and make sure that we're promoting these things, especially in these big cities where there just happen to be teams that are in those cities. Imagine if these things were happening in Boise, Idaho. Imagine if these things were happening in, I don't know, name a big city that doesn't have an NFL team. We wouldn't care. The NFL would not be that involved. But the NFL is involved. Why? Because there's money to be made. And that's what it always comes down to. The NFL can say everything they want the right way. The NFL's clearly doing this because they know this is going to be a tough year for them, financially speaking, especially if there's going to be a minimum amount of fans in the stands at games, or maybe there's only going to be a minimum amount of games that are going to be played. They may lose games. They're in the perfect position position to maximize this as much as possible. So don't mistake the NFL's sudden interest in social issues as them having a sole interest in social issues. No, they're trying to make a buck here. Not a bad thing. Any business would do that. The NFL happens to be under a different spotlight.
All right, and that's the way we can correlate, right, connect the dots to the USC conversation that we were just having a few moments ago. And the reason why I say you can connect those dots is because, again, I'm going to bring it up. There's a 10-year period in which the NCAA mandates that you can have no association with a player that has been found to violate rules. And I believe there was four, if memory serves me right, with Reggie Bush. And again, that disassociation began back in June of 2010. Once that 10-year period is over, according to the COI procedures, the NCAA no longer monitors or enforces that disassociation. The school is then given the freedom to decide how they want to proceed. And Steve, you've been to the campus, obviously, at USC. I've walked that campus many times, and this is not a direct shot at USC. Again, this is the idea of making a buck. You would be foolish to think that when you walk into that bookstore going into 2021, there will not be Reggie Bush jerseys for sale, because there will be.
Of course there will be. There's O.J. Simpson jerseys there. You can buy an O.J. Simpson jersey at the USC bookstore. And if you can buy an O.J. Simpson jersey and look yourself in the mirror the next day, I don't personally care. I mean, he was found not guilty. That's my journalistic world. That's my journalistic world. Hey, he was found not guilty by a jury of his peers. But we know better, right? I mean, what Reggie Bush did was minimal compared to what O.J. Simpson did. But for years, Reggie Bush was persona non grata over there. And, you know, but now you can go and buy one of his jerseys. And again, I'm not mad at Reggie Bush for what he did, because, again, any 19-year-old kid, if you're flashing a Range Rover in the kid's face, you're going to take it. Watch Blue Chips, and you'll get an idea of what happens in college basketball. It's the same thing. So I'm not mad at him. I'm mad that the way it ended up, but I'm more mad at Pete Carroll because he allowed it to happen.
And last segment, Steve, we talked to Galen White, one of my favorite baseball authors and historians. And at the end of that segment, he alluded to the changes in the game of baseball, where the players that he loves to highlight in his work, these were minor league baseball players that had other jobs, multiple other jobs, just to survive. And right now, we have billionaires bickering with millionaires over slight percentages in dollars. Again, you can correlate this. Times have certainly changed with sports, haven't they?
It has been a wacky year. It has been I envy you on a regular basis being able to, you know, wade your way through these waters over the last several months. But it'll be great when we can actually talk sports. But we're seeing now, you know, whether it's a marketing thing here or a marketing thing there or a social issue here or a pandemic or a reaction to a pandemic there, we're finding out a lot about the people behind not just the jerseys, but the people behind the front offices of not just teams, but leagues around sports, not just here, not just in America, but around the world as well.
Steve Bordstein, again, a guest here on Drive Time Sports. Steve, it is always a pleasure to get you on the show to have these conversations. Thank you again for the time today.
Anytime, my friend. Thank you.
It's always great to get Steve Bordstein here on Drive Time Sports. Again, an interesting conversation in a time where we have no current sports to talk about. And the landscape of it has kind of changed. That was kind of the relative theme of the show today. Again, we are out of time. We will be back to do it again tomorrow. We'll have a conversation on the NBA as we inch a little bit closer to restarting the season, potentially now on July 30th. That'll be on Drive Time Sports right here tomorrow. Until then, be safe. I am out.